Chapter 27. The End of Apartment Number 50. When Margarita reached the final words of the chapter, thus the dawn of the 15th day of Nisan found the 5th procurator of Judea, Pontius Pilate. It was already morning. Margarita rose from the chair, stretched, and only now felt just how broken her body was and how much she wanted to sleep. She went into the adjacent room and made sure that the master was sleeping peacefully, extinguished the unnecessary table lamp, and stretched out by the opposite wall on a couch draped with an old torn sheet. A minute later, she was asleep. But at the same time, an entire floor was up and busy in a certain Moscow institution, occupied with the investigation of the Volant case. The first person forced to visit the sleepless, electrically lit floor was Arkady Apollonovich Sempelyarov, chairman of the Acoustics Commission. It goes without saying that Arkady Apollonovich proved to be a sensible and competent witness to the outrageous seance, providing an excellent description of the mysterious masked magician and his two dastardly assistants. He also remembered perfectly well that the magician's name was precisely Volant, and his testimony advanced the investigation considerably. Arkady Apollonovich's statement was juxtaposed with the testimony of others, including that of several ladies who had suffered as a result of the séance, and Karpov, the messenger sent to apartment number 50 on Sadovaya Street. As a result, it was quickly established where the culprit in all these events could be found. They visited apartment number 50, and more than once. No one was to be found in the apartment during any of the visits, and yet there was clear evidence of someone being there, despite the fact that every Moscow official who had anything to do with visiting foreign performers insisted firmly and categorically that there were not, that there could not be any black magicians named Volant in the city. As for Prokhor Petrovich, chairman of the main office of the Entertainment Commission, incidentally, he returned to his empty suit immediately after the police appeared in his office, to the ecstatic joy of Anna Richardovna, and emphatically approved all the resolutions his suit had drafted during his brief absence. Anyhow, Prokhor Petrovich knew absolutely nothing about anyone named Volant. The picture that emerged was one of utter nonsense. Thousands of spectators, in addition to the entire staff of the variety, plus a man as highly educated as Arkady Apollonovich Sempelyarov, had all seen the magician and his thrice-accursed assistants, and yet there was absolutely no way to find him. Proper credit is due to the man heading the investigation. The missing Rimsky was located with astounding speed. It was only necessary to place actions at the cinema taxi stand in the context of certain relevant times of day, such as when the séance ended and the period when Rimsky could have disappeared. Soon, a telegram was dispatched to Leningrad. An hour later, a response came, informing them that Rimsky had been found in room 412 of the Hotel Astoria. Found hiding in the closet, Rimsky was immediately arrested and interrogated in Leningrad. A telegram from Moscow ordered Rimsky delivered there under guard, and as a result, Rimsky boarded the Friday night train, accompanied by said guard. On the same evening, they also managed to pick up Likhodiev's trail. Telegrams inquiring of his whereabouts were dispatched to every city, and a response from Yalta stated that he had been found there and had already left for Moscow by air. The only trail they failed to pick up was Varyonika's. The theatre manager, known to positively all of Moscow, had apparently vanished into thin air. In the meantime, they also had to waste time on things that took place elsewhere in Moscow other than in the Variety Theatre. By far the most unpleasant, scandalous, and inexplicable occurrence was the theft of the deceased Berlioz's head right out of his coffin in the Griboyedov Hall, which took place in broad daylight. 12 men conducted the investigation, gathering, as if on a crochet hook, all the accursed threads of the complex case, scattered all over Moscow. One of the detectives arrived at Professor Stravinsky's clinic and immediately asked to see a list of persons who had been checked into the clinic over the last 3 days. It was Ivan Nikolaevich Homeless, who interested the detective immensely. On Friday night, the door of Ivan's room, number 117, opened, and a young, calm, soft-spoken, round-faced young man stepped inside. He did not look like a detective in the least, yet he was one of Moscow's best. He saw a pale, haggard young man lying on the bed. The investigator introduced himself affectionately and said that he was visiting Ivan Nikolaevich to discuss the events that took place at Patriarch's Ponds the day before yesterday. Oh, great would have been Ivan's triumph had the detective come to him earlier, say on Thursday night at least, when Ivan was demanding passionately and violently that his story be heard. But alas, Ivan had undergone a drastic transformation since the time of Berlioz's death. He answered all of the detective's questions, willingly and politely, but the indifference was clear in both his eyes and his tone. Berlioz's fate no longer concerned the poet. "Tell me, Ivan Nikolaevich, how far were you from the turnstile when Berlioz fell under the tram?" An indifferent, barely noticeable smile appeared on Ivan's face for some reason, and he replied, "I was far away." "And the checkered man was near the turnstile?" "No, he was sitting on a bench nearby." "Can you distinctly recall that he did not approach the turnstile shortly before Berlioz fell?" "I can. He didn't. He was sprawled out on the bench." Those were the detective's last questions. After this, he got up, extended his hand to Ivan, wished him a speedy recovery, and expressed the hope that his poetry would soon reappear in print. "No," Ivan said quietly, "I won't write any more poetry." The detective left Ivan's room with a most important piece of information. Traversing the chain of events from finish to start, he had finally managed to find the source of everything. The detective had no doubt that it all began with the murder on the Patriarchs. Clearly, neither Ivan nor the checkered character had pushed the unfortunate chairman of Massolet under the tram. That is, no one assisted the fall physically, as it were. But the detective was sure that Berlioz had jumped, or fallen, under the tram while in a state of hypnosis. The investigation now had lots of material to work with, and everyone knew who they needed to catch and where. The problem was that they just couldn't seem to be able to do it. It bears repeating that the thrice-accursed apartment, number 50, was undoubtedly inhabited. A rattling or a nasal voice would occasionally answer the telephone, and sometimes the windows would open. Moreover, the sounds of a gramophone would emanate from the apartment. Nonetheless, it was decidedly empty every time they headed over. Yes, something funny was going on in apartment number 50, and yet there was nothing they could do. Things dragged on in this fashion until dawn on Saturday, when new and highly interesting information became available. A 6-person passenger plane from the Crimea landed at Moscow's airport, delivering, among others, a very strange passenger. This young gentleman had heavy stubble on his face and had not bathed for 3 days. He was wearing a sheepskin hat and a Georgian felt cloak directly over his nightshirt, as well as brand new leather slippers. He had barely time to step off the aircraft ladder when he was intercepted. And soon, the Variety's unforgettable director, Stefan Bogdanovich Likhodayev, faced the investigation. He added new information. It became clear that Volant had infiltrated the Variety in the guise of a performer by hypnotizing Stiopa Likhodayev, and then somehow managing to toss him God knows how far out of Moscow. Likhodayev was interred in a bulletproof cell by his own request. Meanwhile, Varyonika appeared before the investigation, having just been arrested in his apartment, where he had returned after almost 2 days of unexplained absence.
His eyes wandering, Ivan Savelyevich whispered in a trembling voice that he feared revenge from the Volant gang, who had already got their hands on him once, and that he asks, begs, yearns to be locked up in a bulletproof cell.
"What the hell is it with them and that bulletproof cell?" grumbled one of the investigators.
They calmed Varyonika as best they could and said they would protect him without the need to resort to a bulletproof cell. Immediately, it was discovered that he had been beaten up by a red-haired man with a fang and another fat one.
"Ah, yes, one that looked like a cat."
"Yes, yes, yes," whispered the manager, paralyzed with fear.
Just then, Rimsky was brought in after arriving on the train from Leningrad. Scarcely recognizable as the former finance director, this panic-stricken, psychologically disturbed, grey-haired old man was very stubborn in his refusal to tell the truth. Rimsky insisted that he had simply felt unwell and had left for Leningrad in a moment of confusion. Needless to say, the ill finance director concluded his testimony with a request to inter him in a bulletproof cell. Arnushka was arrested while attempting to give a $10 bill to a cashier in a department store on the Arbat. She began rambling some nonsense about not being responsible for the management, which had allowed evil spirits to take residence on the fifth floor, thereby making life unbearable. The detective waved his pen at Arnushka and wrote her a pass on a green slip of paper, allowing her to get out. To general satisfaction, Arnushka then vanished from the building. After her came a string of various individuals, Nikolai Ivanovich among them. He had just been arrested due to the folly of his jealous wife, who had filed a report with the police that morning that her husband had gone missing. Nikolai Ivanovich failed to surprise the investigators when he produced the laughable document stating that he had spent the night at Satan's Ball. Nikolai Ivanovich told them about flying Margarita Nikolaevna's naked housekeeper to bathe hell knows where on some river, as well as the preceding appearance of a nude Margarita Nikolaevna in the upstairs window. Nikolai Ivanovich's testimony made it possible to ascertain that both Margarita Nikolaevna and her housekeeper Natasha had vanished without a trace. Measures were taken to find them. Thus, the unceasing investigation went on into Saturday morning. Close to dinner time, the phone rang at the investigation headquarters. Men on Sadovaya were reporting that the damned apartment was again exhibiting signs of life. The windows were opening from the inside, piano music and singing could be heard from within, and a black cat was spotted sunbathing on the windowsill. At around 4 o'clock on the hot afternoon, a large group of plainclothes men emerged from three cars that stopped a short distance away from building number 302B on Sadovaya Street. Here, the large group split up into two smaller groups, one passing through the gate and across the courtyard towards the sixth entrance, and the other unsealing a small, normally boarded-up door leading to the fire escape. Both began to ascend their respective stairs towards apartment number 50. At this time, Kuravyov and Azazello were sitting in the dining room of the apartment and finishing their breakfast. Volant was in the bedroom, as usual, and judging by the clattering of pots and pans in the kitchen, Behemoth was presumably there, fooling around as was his custom.
"Say, what are those steps coming from the staircase?"
Kuravyov asked, twirling his spoon in a cup of black coffee.
"Oh, that's them coming to arrest us,"
Azazello replied, and downed a shot of cognac. The men on the main staircase were already on the third floor, where two plumbers were messing around with a steam heater. The men exchanged meaningful glances with the plumbers.
"Everyone's home," whispered one of the plumbers,
tapping his hammer on a pipe. The leader of the group then openly drew a black Mauser pistol from under his coat, while the man next to him took out a set of master keys. The men heading into apartment number 50 were generally very well equipped. Two of them were carrying light, easily unfolding silk nets in their pockets. Another had a lasso, still another had gauze masks and bottles of chloroform. In a second, the front door of apartment number 50 was opened, and all the men appeared in the hall. A door slammed in the kitchen, indicating the timely arrival of the second group from the fire escape. This time, the effort was met with at least partial success. The men found nothing except for the remnants of an apparently just abandoned breakfast in the dining room and, on the living room mantelpiece, next to a crystal pitcher, an enormous black cat. In his paws was a primer stove. The visitors eyed the cat in complete silence for a considerable length of time.
"Not bothering nobody, just sitting here, mending the primus," said the cat.
A silk net unfurled and flew through the air, but to everyone's surprise, the man throwing the net missed and caught only the jug, which promptly smashed to pieces with a ringing noise.
"Forfeit!"
bellowed the cat, and putting aside the primus, he whipped a Browning automatic from behind his back. He instantly aimed at the man closest to him, but before the cat could fire, something flashed in the target's hand. To the sound of a Mauser shot, the cat flopped headfirst from the mantelpiece to the floor, dropping the Browning and releasing the primus.
"It's all over," the cat said in a weak voice, sprawling languidly in a pool of blood. "Oh, Azazello, my friend, where are you? You abandoned poor Behemoth. The only thing that can save a mortally wounded cat is a drink of petrol."
And he put his mouth to the round fueling port of the primus and helped himself to a good drink of petrol. Immediately, the blood stopped streaming from under his front left paw. The cat jumped up, alive and well, tucked the primus under his arm, and leaped back on the mantelpiece. From there, he scaled the wall and situated himself on a metal curtain rod far above the men. Several hands instantly grabbed the curtain, but neither the fraudulently healed cat nor the primus fell to the floor.
"I challenge you to a duel,"
bellowed the cat, sailing above their heads on the swaying chandelier. He set the primus between the branches of the chandelier, and the Browning reappeared in his paws. Swinging like a pendulum above the visitors, the cat took aim and opened fire. Gunshots shook the apartment. The gunfire raised a panic in the courtyard outside. It did not last very long, however. The problem was that neither the cat nor the visitors sustained any damage. Not only was no one killed, but everyone, including the cat, remained completely unharmed. The cat sailed through the air and landed far above the floor on the golden frame of the mantelpiece mirror. Now that he was sitting in relative safety, the cat commenced,
"I fail to understand the reasons for such harsh treatment of my person."
And then his speech was interrupted by a low, heavy voice coming out of nowhere.
"What's going on in the apartment? You are interrupting my work."
An unpleasant nasal voice replied,
"It's Behemoth, of course, damn him to hell."
A third rattling voice said,
"Messiah, it's Saturday. The sun is setting. Time to go." "Forgive me, but I cannot stay and chat,"
the cat said from the mirror.
"Time to go."
He hurled his Browning and knocked out both window panes. Then he poured petrol on the floor and it ignited spontaneously, raising a wall of fire all the way to the ceiling. With a meow, the cat jumped from the mirror onto the windowsill and disappeared together with his primus. Meanwhile, in the spot where the cat had been lying with his fake wound, the corpse of the former Baron Maigel congealed from the air, glassy-eyed, with its chin thrust high up. There was no way to get it out. Beating out their smouldering chests and shoulders, the men in the living room ran out through the corridor. Someone managed to dial the fire department on his way out and shouted curtly into the phone, "Sadovaya, 302B! Just as they heard the heart-stopping sound of bells on the long red trucks speeding toward Sadovaya from all over the city, the people running around the courtyard saw three dark, seemingly male silhouettes fly out of the fifth-floor window amid the smoke, as well as one silhouette of a nude woman.